This is Authors Voices, a podcast of live readings of authors at writerscast.com. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Gordon Ball, and he'll be reading from his book called 66 Frames, a memoir of his year 1967 to 68 in New York, after graduating from a small religiously oriented men's college in North Carolina. As a senior, his invitation to avant-garde filmmaker Jonas Mekas changed his life, for when Mekas stepped off the train in Charlotte, North Carolina, he handed Ball a movie camera. Soon, Gordon was in New York working for Mekas, meeting other filmmakers and artists, including Andy Warhol. He was likewise involved in the huge countercultural sea change and living with a vivid, energetic young woman named Candy. This is Gordon Ball reading from 66 Frames, published by Coffee House Press.
From a chapter on the beach. This is August 1967. On the beach, one. Candy and I still had hopes for California. That is, Candy especially wanted to see firsthand the extraordinary flowering of San Francisco in the summer of 1967. Now, summer approached its end. We could hitchhike there, but we couldn't count on making a real trip of it. Inside of 2 weeks, the most I could be gone from the filmmakers' cooperative. We couldn't afford a bus, not to mention a plane. Through someone at the studio where she modeled, Candy located a drive-away car with a man at an agency in New Jersey. Late one Friday afternoon, after I got off work, we headed, full of expectation, for an obscure location across the Hudson. We'd leave for California the next morning. Candy's contact, a dark, curly-haired man in an open-neck white short-sleeved shirt named Mr. Lintricia, met us inside his weakly lit garage under a large, ancient wooden ceiling fan that turned slowly with a tick. He smiled. I could see spots of saliva around his gums beneath his lower teeth, and showed us a big black Cadillac, which he said was ready to roll. But it had no license plate. That didn't matter, he quickly reassured, just in case a policeman sometime or someplace should express interest. He was having a letter drawn up for us. It would explain everything. The license would be arriving in just a few days. We returned to 57 Thompson as we'd come, by bus and subway, except now glumness replaced expectation. Yet we remained determined to break from the city, even if just for the rest of the weekend. Candy called her parents, who were vacationing in the resort town of Asbury Park on the Jersey coast. Excusing the sudden notice, might we join them? Saturday morning, each of us rolled up a sleeping bag, slung it over our shoulders, headed for Port Authority. Candy had been looking forward to thanking her father face-to-face for his help with her Mexican divorce. Then we'd have dinner, visit some more, and the two of us would sleep on the floor or out on the porch. We knew they already had friends staying with them. In case we ended up with extended free time, we brought 2 hits of acid. Such was how we imagined it, at least. We didn't get to the Asbury Park bus station until late afternoon. Sleeping bags on backs, we asked for directions as we left the station. But having trouble finding the right house, we asked further as we walked along, first one way and then the next. Tired to begin with from little sleep from Friday night's fiasco, we finally found the right single-story frame house, raised high on stilts like so many of its nearly identical neighbors. The Mills' house guests were out when we arrived, and Candy and her mother and father, both in dressy sports attire, hugged each other warmly as I shook hands. With zest, Candy got in her expression of gratitude to her father. Then we made chit-chat for some moments. Then for a few more. Then I began to wonder what was going on. Both her parents seemed to be withholding something, yet they looked straight at us, as if studying. Finally, her father came out with it, eyeing us up and down as he spoke. We're not sure it would be a good idea for you to stay the night. We don't like the way you look, the way you dress. We don't like your values, and that, in all his looming seriousness, he stuttered an instant. You persist in making a show of it. We don't know if we want you under the same roof. His blonde, curly-haired wife, who'd stood next to him endorsing his words with silent, emphatic nods, not without a tremble at her lower lip, then took the floor. And what do you think our neighbors here will think, seeing what you look like? We were dressed, much as in our spring visit to their home, perhaps more openly so in the warmer weather, jeans, tight bell-bottoms, paisleys. Perhaps one or both of us wore beads. Candy's splaying auburn hair was, as always, Candy's splaying auburn hair. Her thin sleeveless blouse naturally revealed the dramatic outlines of her breasts. Perhaps my hair was slightly longer than in the spring. I hadn't shaved in a day or two, but my beard was always very light, and it was summer anyway, and the beach. And likely I wore my shirt tail out, as I often did in warm weather. We were dumbfounded, hurt, angry. Had her father thought his $300 for the divorce would straighten us out? I wasn't going to find out. And Mrs. Mills hadn't finished. She turned to her daughter. You look like a failure, a loose woman, and you come here on foot with bundles on your backs. What do you think it looks like? I got furious and shouted back. We care more about reality than appearances. I turned to Candy. She was weeping profusely. We reached for our sleeping bags, rushed across porch and downstairs, and were back on the street again. I kissed Candy, and holding each other tight, we retraced our steps, except with none of the false turns. Now it was as if we'd been coming there since childhood, to the Asbury Park bus station. As we started to enter, I heard a large metallic hum just behind us. I turned. There was Mr. Mills, pulling up his green Buick Regal. Please come back, he called from the car as he shut the engine. Please come back, he called as he got out. Under his horn-rimmed glasses, his eyes looked worn. I stepped aside as Candy went to him and they touched and talked. Then they made a sort of affectionate, heartfelt handshake, all four hands, like an athletic duo bonding just before facing opposition. Then that broke into a sort of a hug, and Candy turned to me, made an effort at a smile, and the two of us joined her father in the front seat, after laying our bundles in the rear. On our return, her mother seemed at least to be holding a stiff upper lip. None of us pretended differences had been resolved, but no one fought. By then, it was early evening. Soon friends would join hosts and house guests who'd returned in our absence. We had something to eat, then socializing and bridge playing became the order of the evening. When the Mills and the Sanders get together on a Saturday night, watch out! Candy's mother shouted at one rollicking high point. Mouths sprang open in laughter, glasses clinked in abandon. Candy and I hung around nearby, trying to be friendly as we abstained from the drinking. We went for a walk, then returned, sat around. Yet another couple had dropped by, revving things up to new heights. The partying now seemed as if it wouldn't end. Candy went up to her parents and told them we were going for a long walk on the beach, that we might even stay the night there. Not to worry, we'd be back mid-morning. We slipped our sleeping bags over our shoulders once more as we set out on foot again. It was now near midnight and dark, except the sky was clear with a few bright stars. We headed toward the beach, stepped into the water's edge, beheld waves roar and crash farther out, then soothe their way in up close. Up in the velvet sky, a shy moon was fading in, bright enough to sparkle the tear and roll of the waves. The water was mild as it rushed our bare, tired feet, begging its foamy way above our ankles. We retreated 10 yards from the water's edge, back under supporting beams and trusses, behind boardwalk piers where all was dark. Now we could still see and hear the ocean without getting wet. We slipped off our bags and took the acid. We were taking liberty with Leary's stipulation regarding setting. We were in an unfamiliar spot. Also, weren't we still in at least a somewhat disturbed mindset following the earlier wholesale upheaval? Nevertheless, we felt we knew the acid we had. In 20 minutes, I could feel it start, that same not unpleasant sensation in the back of the neck. After another 20 or 30, as the waves coursed their inevitable path toward us and away from us, I began to enter a state of mind reminiscent of lines from Whitman. In Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, he'd written, "The sea, delay not, hurry not, whispered me through the night, lisped to me the low and delicious word, death, and again, death, 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 hissing, melodious, edging near as privately for me, rustling at my feet, creeping thence steadily up to my ears, and laving me softly all over, death, 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 death. Farther out they rose and cracked in massive plunge and might and thud and yell. There they suggested to me, called to me, impressed upon me the death of all that lived. It was the utter truth about the universe, and there was nothing I could do about it. I sat there saying subvocally, I'm dying. I'm not dying. I was putting up ego resistance when all I needed to do was recognize, oh, yes, I am, like all else, or perhaps see and accept the cyclic, illusory nature of it, as I'd failed to do once at Millbrook. Thus, for me, it was a matter of internal endurance for about 3/4 of an hour, Candy at my side, my feelings unspoken, only a few brief and occasional exchanges between us. Then, suddenly, we noticed a moving light on the beach, out under old stars and a now stronger moon, between water and boardwalk, and it was coming closer. Then we heard a command, "Who's there? Come out!" I could see a silhouette. There was just enough light to make out the bluish tinge of a uniform, some 10 or so feet beyond the darkness of our boardwalk structure. In good faith, I got up, advanced toward it. Half a dozen steps later, I left the enclosing shadow of beam and board and pier, the entire invisible realm, and suddenly manifested before my interlocutor in the world of star and moonlight. I was but a few feet from him, as if materialized instantaneously from nothingness. He seemed startled and quickly took one step back as he drew a dark yet reflecting metallic object from his right hip and pointed it at my face. "Raise your hands. Who are you? What are you doing here?" My hands raised themselves. We stood less than 6 feet from each other. He seemed young, short-haired, about my size. "We're just looking at the ocean," I explained. "Do you have identification?" I reached in my hip pocket for my wallet, handed him my North Carolina driver's license. "I'm sorry if I startled you," I said. I didn't want to use the word scared. I didn't want to risk making him feel worse or excite him further. He returned his pistol to its holder and took my license with his right hand, holding his flashlight on it with his left. By now, Candy had appeared near me from under the boardwalk. Her manifestation, fortunately, didn't surprise him like mine. He studied the ID. "No one's allowed on the beach after 11 p.m., so you can't stay." "Oh, we didn't know," I started. "We were just visiting my folks who have a house here and thought to take a late night walk out under the stars, maybe even sleep out here." Candy's whiskish voice came in.
"Okay, but not around here. Have you been drinking?"
"No," we chimed in silent amusement. He held out my license. As I took it, I asked on a hunch, "Are you in college?"
"Yeah, during the year. This is how I pay for school."
"Oh, good.
You can go farther down that way," he added, pointing with his light before he shut it off. "Once the boardwalk ends, there are no restrictions."
Now we both thanked him and turned and started up the rickety wooden stairs. Then he called after us.
"So you're a Capricorn," he said.
"Well, yes," I answered. "And you?"
"Aquarius."
"Oh, neat. Water," I exclaimed. "Well, good night."
"Good night."
2. We remembered our sleeping bags and came back for them.
At a somewhat higher prospect, we found a spot in the sand beyond the boardwalk, facing ocean and horizon. I had no worries about death now, and slowly, slowly, as we sat watching the waves glimmer vaguely, a little haze was building up. A broad arc of the lower horizon began to mutate into light. Then, as more time passed, the tip of a flat persimmon-colored disk expressed itself like a seed sprouting from earth, slowly fading into the consciousness of the horizon. It began to rise. It looked flat and empty, and as I stared at its expanding, rising flatness, I began to conceive of all nature as a prop, like any man-made artifice, like those I'd seen before on LSD, city streets at 4 a.m. when I'd noted the two-dimensional stage set-like outlines of buildings, whole blocks of streets like a theater set, deserted by actors, crew, audience. It was as I'd see 4 years later, riding with friends under the stars on the back of a truck hairpinning down mountains in Sonoma County hours after a September midnight. All trees, left and right, near and far, as flat as a pressed leaf against the sky. All nature, a dark, abandoned set. Now, I said to Candy, my face to the horizon, a tinge of salt on my lips, the sun is pop, as it swelled to immense flattened breadth. It was like an item in some universe supermarket, available every day, always in stock. It was as thin and illusionistic as the label on a can of Campbell's soup, as the mirror of it held by Andy.
Thank you very much. That was Gordon Ball reading from 66 Frames, published by Coffee House Press.